Well, hi, everybody, and welcome. Thank you again for tolerating the techno glitch, and I hope you received the copy of what I dictated from the outline that we both operate from, and that will be a stand-in for the recording that didn't happen last time. So we're about to do our fourth seminar. Just as a brief overview, we did the first seminar on stress mastery strategies and tools, and then the neuroscience of peak performance last time, and the outline and dictation that you received as an attachment, peak performance under pressure, or to put it scientifically, how to get your butterflies to fly in formation. And we're going to be talking about extreme stress strategies in this seminar. This is something that I think is important and often overlooked as we do coaching with clients, because when a client moves to a successful place, endeavor, performance, whatever they do, because of the work with you, often they're in a place beyond where they've been before, and they may not have the model or the internal organization of models and intuition to deal with extreme success or with success in a place they have never been before, because the experience has been transformational. So that's what I have in mind in looking at discussing this with you, to look at the challenges of success that will create a different experience for your client, perhaps than has ever been experienced before. First, let me pause and ask if there are questions or comments, anything you'd like to add or ask before we move into our final seminar discussion. Any clarifications, things to add, to be sure we talk about, anything at all? If not, I'll put us on lecture mode. Final call. Anything to add, ask, or want to be sure we talk about? Okay, hold on. Okay, we're going to talk about, and I'll reserve some time at the end for questions, comments, so be sure to jot down anything you want to cover. So in talking about extreme success challenges, first let's talk about exceptional achievement and overconfidence. Here's an illustration. If you ask any player in a physician's basketball league, and I know these things, whether he or she would compete with LeBron James, they'd laugh. Yet many of those same physicians willingly compete with billionaire investor Warren Buffett. Cognitive biases and mental errors make them believe they can outperform successful full-time investment experts. Those who have achieved in exceptional ways create challenges for themselves because of the very attainment of that success. Some highly successful individuals, from expert actors, athletes, to practicing medical, legal, coaching experts, begin to believe they can be good in other areas, for example, investing. Expertise in one area, though, does not equate with expertise in another. Even Warren Buffett recognized this about himself. He said, "I don't think being able to allocate capital means you're good at anything else." He was a very humble guy and recognized limitation. Overconfidence creates a misperception of ability when it's informed by spectacular success in another area. University of Pennsylvania psychologists Philip Tetlock and Barbara Mellers studied over 25,000 forecasts from people whose task it was to anticipate how the future would unfold. And these are experts in the various areas they were asked to predict. Their studies, like a number of others, have revealed exceptional overconfidence. And people included in these groups, doctors, lawyers, engineers, even scientists, in their decision-making processes. The stimulation of overconfidence can be habituating and biologically habituating. Look at the most recent revelations of politicians, actors, athletes who came to believe their success made them immune to boundary violations. From Macbeth, we learn that we are most vulnerable not when we're beginning, not when we are destitute or needy, but after the biggest triumphs of our lives. For Macbeth, the moment the witches came was after the most massive successes he had ever experienced of winning two battles and enjoying immense popularity. Just look at Elvis, Marilyn, Janice, F. Scott, Kurt, Belushi, Philip Seymour. Some people need mentor coaches not to become successful, but to help them regulate their states of mind to sustain success, manage emotions in order to do that. Complacency and overconfidence become equal challenges. So navigating extreme success can create some particular challenges. Exceptional success transcends all usual and expectable categories, such as the athlete who plays really well or defies the limits of physical aging. It also occurs when accomplishments or the resultant fame or wealth or power transcend any possible anticipation or preparation or especially any internal model of how to sustain it and self-regulate. Keith Richards put it most succinctly, fame has killed more very talented guys than drugs. So let's look at some aspects of this, things that I think you'll see sooner or later in your coaching work with clients. First is success anticlimax. After Bruce Jenner's last decathlon in Montreal, the next morning he asked, what am I going to do now? He had spent four decades doing one thing. After a long practice and anticipated success, people often have to deal with success anticlimax. The sprint system, the excitement mediated by dopamine, can sustain expectation, anticipating a consequence. And we know from various performers, this can last for years or even decades. This shift, then, at the time of success to the neurochemical marathon system instead of the sprint system is designed to sustain and balance endeavors. But somebody can read it as if it's a lack of excitement, as if something's missing now, and even to feel slightly depressed. Robert Louis Stevenson said it very simply, to travel hopefully is a better thing than to arrive. To travel hopefully sustains dopamine release. Arriving shifts to that marathon system of norepinephrine, which can read as, this isn't exciting as I thought it was. Something's missing. The athletes and executives I've worked with and others I've interviewed have learned to contend with the anticlimax of shifting from stimulating anticipation to sustaining maintenance and to dose anticipation and continued success in an effective way. Here's a simple example that I was introduced to way back in the day and didn't even realize it. My favorite athletic coach's first introduction to me of his version of this aspect of sports psychology. As a freshman, I was fortunate to make the traveling squad of 12 players in basketball And I was intimidated by the upperclassmen surrounding me most of the time. Just after we won our first tournament and boarded our bus, Coach stood at the front of the bus and looked at each of us. We were all feeling really good at the big win, and you know, the whole context of the tournament. We were eager to get home and celebrate with a parade downtown. And he said, "So we won this tournament. This is not the biggest or the most prestigious tournament that we'll play. It's kind of a podunk tournament." He said, "How many of you can really say you're proud to win this tournament?" Now, under any circumstance, I would have raised my hand, as I suspected my teammates would, but nobody dared venture a single finger in the air. He concluded, "Feel good for now, but let's get home and really start working on being an excellent team." Coach knew how to handle success anticlimax, to ladder success. His life-changing coaching and the mentoring of me in sports resulted in many wins and honors. But most importantly, it launched two resultant careers of helping others succeed. First, psychiatry psychoanalysis, and then mentor coaching. For any physical or intellectual achievement, the emotional role and creative closure have to be addressed upon a successful completion. I've known a number of authors who described a letdown after completion of their book. One even described it as a postpartum depression, and that was a guy. The most successful achievers have evolved their capacity to recover faster from success anticlimax and look at laddering and creating a strategy and a system for ongoing success. Now, let's look at this question. Does proven evidence change beliefs? You guys know it doesn't. Facts and beliefs are anatomical realities in our brain. You don't create a change by suddenly introducing a new great idea and expect it to overwrite the one that's already there in your client or in your brain. Many of you have heard me say, if information was enough, we'd all exercise every day, eat mostly vegetables, be thin, and have a lot of money saved up for the future. And a lot of librarians would be billionaires. But facts and logic are not powerful tools to alter opinions. This is why it's usually distracting and certainly useless to offer opinions and suggestions and strategies to our clients. Data is not a way to change minds. It's not how we decide. Established beliefs are very resistant to change, even when scientific evidence disproves those beliefs. People regard information as valid evidence when it reinforces what they already believe. This is how arguments more staunchly solidify an original position. If you present someone with information that contradicts an opinion or a belief that they already have, this will most likely cause that person to generate new counterarguments to further strengthen their view. It's called in neuroscience the boomerang effect. They're more established than before they received that information. As a result, people grow more confident in their initial convictions and use information to polarize opinions. Think about how this happens, and you already have picked a side when you're listening to or engaging things. Abortion, gun control, climate change. We quickly accept evidence that confirms our notions, and we assess counter evidence with a critical, even disbelieving eye. We are ready to disprove it, and that's where our focus and energy goes. We then cherry-pick information to fortify our beliefs without even being consciously aware of it. Confirmation bias. In fact, recent studies have shown that the more intelligent people are, the greater their ability to creatively rationalize and interpret information to fit their opinions or to disprove that which doesn't. They use their intelligence not to examine data or to draw a more accurate conclusion, but to find fault in data they already disbelieve. The mind's desire for continuity and certainty, coupled with activating the brain's error detection mechanism with new and unexpected information, both contribute to the continuity of belief and action. And as you know, in working with clients, this is where we often need to begin in a collaborative alliance to get our client curious about something that they think or say or feel, and curious together to explore it without a premature foreclosure or just letting it go. So how we establish that collaborative alliance is an important framework of working with a client. So let's look for just a moment at success traps. And let's use business as more objective example. The success trap in business is almost ubiquitous, in which a company must shift the way it operates in order to survive. Kodak, who stuck to analog photography, did not evolve to digital. The canal boat companies of the 1700s didn't become the railroad companies of the 1800s. They stuck to their box. And in the 1900s, there were no Union Pacific Airlines. They stuck to their box. Good to gone. More recently, Andy Grove at Intel established the success trap, or described the success trap, as being a time in an organization's life. And think about the parallel here. This is a sidebar, but think about the parallel with your client describing and experiencing success in what they do, and for us to listen and begin to listen together. The success trap, a time in an organization's or individual's life when the leaders have to think differently and move away from what they've done to develop and refine what's successfully in place, and to think creatively of what can be. Andy Grove said, miss the moment and you start to decline. He noted the difficulty at Intel to move from memory chips at the time to embrace the next technology of microprocessing in order to sustain the viability of the entire company. Successful performance for an individual or company can sustain focus on what created the success rather than looking to the next success and what must change and evolve. The new success becomes the old success unless there's an evolving model to use. Attention to execution of the current success may miss the innovation needed to take new steps or approach it simply with a growth mindset. Here's one example. Brain scans of 63 seasoned business decision makers showed two things. Moving to new territory of exploratory strategies disengages from the pleasing routine of certainty. Remember, our brain seeks certainty and wants the default mode because it's way easier and creates satisfaction. To leave the default mode to attend to new possibilities is uncomfortable. It takes more energy. It takes tolerating uncertainty. This is where we are operating at that interface every moment with our client, to look at what can be, what is, and understanding that. At the same time, creative innovation stimulates brain circuitry of both anticipation and reward, and that's important to keep in mind too. So coupled with this discomfort of not simply doing the default mode and what's expected, which is comfortable and certain, there's also the anticipation that can create excitement. There's that dialectic always. So let's look at some performance-related biases and their remedies. This is something I just want to talk about with you so that you'll have a better recognition of these sorts of things that can be so automatic otherwise. There are some specific biases, often created or exaggerated, especially by success, that have a unique impact on performance. Awareness of the tendency of these biases to psychologically influence our decisions and even dilute then optimum performance becomes important to recognize. And this is why I want to highlight just a few of these. One is self-deception. These deceptions have been distilled from a number of studies. One is self-inflation, especially at times of significant success, because success creates a mindset of excitement and stimulation. 94% of people place themselves at the top half of their profession. 70% of both men and women feel they're better looking than average. 19% of people believe they're in the top 1% of income. 70% of drivers believe they're better than average. I know here in Texas that's not true, at least. 75% of people consider themselves healthier than average. Another is the derogation of others. This is the shadow story of self-inflation. It occurs when an image has been tarnished or there's a need to align with an in-group and degrade the outgoing, or to align with the powerful, the Stockholm syndrome, and identification with the aggressor to participate in that power. Another, moral superiority. Well, naturally, the referees are right when they call a foul on the visiting team. And one of the worst mistakes they can make is calling a foul on my favorite home team. Now, if I ever moved to Dallas, it wouldn't be on the Rockets. It would instantly become my favorite Maverick. And I know these things. Another is the illusion of control. When we feel a lack of control, it enhances our tendency to see meaningful patterns in otherwise random data. It gives us a false sense of effectiveness. Think about the allure of conspiracy theories. It brings an understanding and a closure to things that otherwise make no sense whatsoever. Another, invincibility bias. Some common examples of invincibility bias include adolescents. That's their job description at times when they underestimate danger and exaggerate anticipated performance and engage in risky behavior. Heavy smokers underestimate their cancer risk despite objective awareness. Skiers ignore warning signs and enter restricted areas of dangerous terrain. Someone sees a roulette wheel stop on red 6 times in a row and believes the chances are a little higher than 50-50 it will stop on black the next time. 100% of those who believe the roulette wheel has a memory will abandon the 50-50 red-black probability, and some will win on their next bet and be right for the wrong reason. Another, optimism bias. Optimism bias is our tendency to underestimate the possibility of bad events in our lives and to overestimate the possibility of good events. We underestimate the likelihood of a car accident, of having cancer, overestimate our life expectancy, even future income. Newlyweds estimate the likelihood of divorce is in the single digits, while statistically 40% will end in divorce. Hindsight bias. Knowing how things turned out can influence the way we remember and even reframe past events to make an outcome seem inevitable. Think about Nassim Taleb's black swan effect. Another, subjectivity bias. We have an ability to spot thinking and systematic errors in other people, yet we may struggle to look objectively to assess our own, simply because we are observers of others and can't as easily bring into objective focus our own process of thinking and behaving, because that's on autopilot. That is part of our unconscious operating system. Now, once you recognize something that's unconscious and make it in focus, and it's no longer unconscious. Another present bias. We put great value in the present, so much that it may make a massive future reward one that we forego for the pleasure of the present. People jeopardize their future for instant pleasure in the present. Unhealthy snacks, procrastinating on exercise, spending now in lieu of saving for the future. Nutrition and exercise for longevity may be trumped by an immediate pleasure of eating. People with a present bias invest less in their retirement accounts or in future health. The future is both a theory and an abstraction, so it competes poorly with the immediate reward and the pleasure chemical of dopamine. Another is a transparency bias. When we perceive fairness, the brain releases the pleasure chemical of dopamine. When we perceive unfairness, this triggers the reptilian brain that mediates the perception of threat and survival, which is its own neurochemical system. Fairness, a keystone in both collaboration and leadership, can be overridden by the sense of unfairness that can interfere with creativity, motivation, and even teamwork. A major factor in the perception of fairness is transparency. The effort that we perceive that goes into a task or item. We often use the amount of effort we actually see as a shortcut for the perception of value. For example, when something takes very little time or looks easy, or when the work itself is not visible, not transparent to the recipient, a significant reaction can occur. An example is an attorney charging $500 an hour for work that's not transparent, or a plumber charging $200 for a visit when the actual repair work only takes 2 minutes. Here's another example. If two people who live together are put in separate rooms and each asks the amount of housework the other does, the combined figure is almost always over 100%. There's a transparency asymmetry. Each is aware primarily of his or her own work, but unaware of the extent of the work of the other. So we underestimate that. We value and perceive more accurately what's transparent. Projection bias. People believe that others hold the same beliefs and values they do and will into the future. Fan psychology employs some innate projection bias, as being a fan of a particular team or group by definition can distort thinking and creates bias. We identify with a player or performer or organization, and our thinking then influences how we perceive and our behaviors even. This can go, as we talked a moment ago, how we view a call by a referee, for example, and we immediately lapse into all or nothing, good or bad thinking. Another example is seeing how ethnocentric our own views in the United States are when traveling to different parts of the world. This was absolutely eye-opening for me as I began earlier to travel to other countries and see how very insular we are in the United States. A projection of our belief or value onto another instantly creates a connection, on the other hand. Both projection bias as well as fan psychology are in part about belonging, identifying with a group that shares beliefs and values. So how do we think as coaches about ways to be curious about or even remedy biases? A bias means we not only ignore certain data, but we specifically ignore disconfirming data. Facts contrary to beliefs and self-images are rapidly dismissed or just not engaged. So a cue for a bias can simply be an anchor to boot up a particular mindset. And think about how this can be race or gender or weight or any number of other things that are automatically and largely unconsciously attributed. Then natural gravitation occurs to others who share the same mindset to engage in groupthink, to further the notions and find evidence to affirm them. Groupthink can be simply shared blind spots. We ignore contrary evidence and share a self-deception. We work diligently to preserve our opinions, even though we may not consciously know exactly what they are. So the challenge then is to recognize, own, and assess aspects of our own story, the first three steps of the roadmap system: recognize, own, and assess. The primary reasons it's a challenge: new information may disrupt our default mode. It may cause unpleasant feelings. New information can demand a change of beliefs. We tend to seek information that confirm our beliefs rather than disprove them. And new information may require us to take undesired actions or simply to depart from the known and the default mode, which takes work. To leave the security of our known stories and the certainty and predictability of how it will turn out can feel like a lack of control. Repetition, even though it doesn't perhaps get us what we want or it's limiting, can read as effectiveness because we can predict the outcome, especially if we expect bad news. Seeking a consultation with a doctor about certain symptoms confronts denial and the pain of undergoing testing. It's also more difficult when the information is hard to understand or interpret. So we first have to realize what we don't know. This is tough. This is difficult because how do you come to know what you don't know? Candid, open feedback from trusted others becomes one way. This is where we engage with our clients at times as mentor coaches. In coaching, in executive coaching, sometimes there's a use of a 360-degree assessment instrument so that other people in an inner circle do an assessment on one person and gives feedback to that person. This significantly challenges the comfort zone, but can provide objective, valuable information. You may not need to do that in a formal way. Get together a group of your buddies and ask them for feedback. One thing to consider, that this is something to listen for, and I want to talk about the hubris syndrome. While confidence is a state of mind that generates remarkable productivity, overconfidence can slay success. While our minds constantly learn from challenges internally and externally, the creative and empathic process can be derailed by the experience, the state of mind of any of the accompaniments of success: power, influence, fame, wealth. It's been shown that the more that we know and the better we become, the more likely we are to overestimate our own ability, as well as to underestimate the events beyond our control. In one study, CEOs became more confident as they gained merger and acquisition experience, which resulted in their overvaluing subsequent deals. In research from the University of Vienna, investors who obtained significant experience with their market became overconfident and made risky and failing asset trades. Overconfidence and the brain's stimulation can sustain and enhance with success and power. This is one of the major aspects of success, is it changes state of mind, just as failure does. This is why it's so important, I believe, one of the major thing that we do as mentor coaches, in my view, is to help a client regulate states of mind and manage emotions, and then to practice within that ideal state to be able to perform within it. Overconfidence increases with familiarity, repetition, information, and success. Blind certainty can replace active self-reflection. One of the best predictors of overconfidence is power, which enhances with time and experience and can result in stopping questioning alternate possibilities. And this is one of the things that we see and will see with political, with celebrity figures, is there's an intoxication of power. The state of mind that comes with power or wealth or fame, that the boundaries increasingly erode a bit, so there's an escalation of hubris, of the use and result of that success. Now, let's talk for a minute about talent. A growth mindset recognizes talents can be enhanced through dedication and deliberate practice. A fixed mindset, on the other hand, sees talent as either present or not present, not to be developed. Edwin Moses, winner of 107 consecutive races and 4 world records, said, "I ran against a lot of individuals who were probably more physically talented." We now know from a number of perspectives that talent is not a genetic gift, but a developmental process. It can be enhanced when it's recognized, focused on, nurtured. Parents, teachers, coaches, mentor. Discipline and deliberate practice involve both intellectual and physical talent. The social setting and enhancing framework contribute to both motivation and maturation of talent. This is how we can use some of the things that we've been talking about to facilitate and enhance our clients' engagement in state of mind, in deliberate practice, and in performance. To recognize and advance, let's say to apply it here, in sports talent, in the socially prominent areas are easy. Baseball, basketball in the United States, soccer in England, ice hockey in Canada. Sports make it easy because they're so visible, they're identifiable, they're measurable. Talent in other areas may not be as easily recognized, perhaps not even visibly apparent or transparent. Talent in art, verbal ability, physical and mental skills become challenges to identify and facilitate. While there are different innate physical and mental capacities, just as individual personality and learning styles, the developmental process must be systematically nurtured by discipline and practice. So an optimum model from various studies about the development of expertise and talent includes 3 aspects. Early diversification, sampling of a number of activities, and exposure for both informed choices and long-term involvement. Note here that what is a key factor is the development of each individual story based on their interests, their needs, their ideals. Deliberate play, for example, of experiencing sport through fun and playful games builds a solid foundation of intrinsic motivation. Deliberate play establishes a range of cognitive and motor experiences to develop both expertise and self-management, as well as a foundation of generalizable skills. Only later then, perhaps in most studies, by age 13 should specialization occur. And only by late adolescence have children developed the physical, social, cognitive, emotional, motor skills need to specialize in one sport or one endeavor. These studies were compiled by Dr. Eddie O'Connor, the psychology of performance. A composite of studies of elite performers across a number of fields found some common traits that characterize development and experience. Managing anxiety in pressure situations. There's a reason that's number one. Confidence, mental toughness and resilience. The ability to focus and block distractions. A hard work ethic. The practice of setting and achieving goals. Being coachable and working with expert coaches or mentors. And optimism. Now, is there a disadvantage of talent? Well, the talent myth assumes a fixed mindset. Well, why spend time and energy trying to improve if success only comes to people with the right talent or genes? That skill and intelligence can be improved is a growth mindset. So looking at this in that way, in terms of it being a growth mindset, is an important aspect. Now, I've also seen, and there are a few studies, that a shadow story of talent is that it can mask poor teaching or coaching for a significant period of time, or even until it's time to play a bigger game in some challenging way, intellectually or physically. Now, let's look at sustainable success. And I want to give you a case example here to illustrate. After their first unprecedentedly successful whirlwind tour of the United States, the first thing the Beatles did when they got back to England was to go to the studio and make the next album. And they made a new album regularly every 6 months. They didn't bask in their glory or let it derail their plans. They consolidated the success to integrate it with ongoing focus and plans. They pressed their advantage, but did not let success derail their plans or hijack their focus. Now, a client I'm going to call Evelyn consulted me because she was having a burnout in her career. She had enjoyed remarkable and fairly rapid success as an actress, quickly moving through local theater, national commercials, and roles in a couple of nationally syndicated series. Her energy brightened the room. It induced optimism in others, and people were impressed with her imagination and creative presence. Being highly intuitive and sensitive allowed her attunement and connection to others, as well as an immersion, a brilliant immersion, into the character she played. With this sensitivity came the resonance with stressful emotions from those around her, and this resulted at times in feeling emotionally drained, especially by crowds. She was exquisitely sensitive and aware, and when she was around family or friends, especially by fans, who would approach her at any public place wanting her autograph or a selfie, she wanted to please them. She understood. She enjoyed the popularity, but it depleted her after these experiences. So she questioned whether the burnout meant that she was not suited for what she was doing, even though she enjoyed the recognition and the stardom a great deal and seemed passionate about developing her craft throughout all of it. We explored her state of mind after these experiences. She described how she had to go home because she was depleted, and she would feel drained for hours. Even a nap would not restore her energy. Her high degree of creativity and imagination was a natural for her expert work, but she didn't have some necessary buffers and boundaries in place to regulate her state of mind for her private time that resulted in then significant depletion. She needed to develop an internal point of reference even more than most individuals, as her intuitive empathic style, at times selfless, was eroding the joy from her accomplishments and her private time. We focused on her desire to resonate with and nurture others that needed to be developed within herself first, to not abandon herself, to remain grounded in her own experience. She then developed a way to carve out her private space and a time devoted to her needs once being more clear about them, and her ideals, and have specific boundaries of her interface with others. And these needs and these ideals helped her be even more grounded in her identity, not abandoning them to respond to others. These pragmatic strategies allowed her to preserve her energy and to deploy it by conscious choice rather than in a reactive mode. For example, she developed an awareness of how the character that she inhabited for a screen role was itself a state of mind, a persona, and how to effectively enter and exit that state of mind, that persona, each day so that she could preserve her own private space and not intermingle the two. She learned to dose, time, and titrate her exposure to others, to reduce the excessive stimulation of crowds, especially of needy and negative people, to reframe unnecessary self-care, not feeling guilty saying no. A sidebar here. How you frame something determines the state of mind you boot up to deal with it. If you say no to someone who wants or asks something of you and feel guilty, then that's a very different state of mind than if you say, no, thank you for the offer, but I have my own determination of what I need to do now. No simply means thank you, but I have a way I need to take care of myself. So how you frame something can determine how you respond. She learned the value of meditation, how to emotionally decompress and recharge, of calming many breaks throughout the day, to do a two-minute mindfulness meditation as a response to signals that might otherwise have triggered a default mode of reactivity. So by protecting herself in this way and being attuned to the necessary boundaries between herself and others, she maintained her valued sensitivity and empathic resonance with herself as well as others without absorbing the impact of the feelings of others. So, being a very visual person, her mantra included a visual focus rather than a word phrase. She envisioned being enveloped in a cone of white, warm light around her entire body that offered energy as well as protection. It blocked any negativity as well as restored her own energy and internal point of reference. She developed that right before she was a guest on a national interview and knew that she needed, particularly for this interview, to be focused, grounded, and developed this and then used it subsequently. So these necessary steps to stay centered in an otherwise very demanding world of fame proved invaluable for her to sustain her energy and to continue to contribute in ways she valued. This allowed her full emotional engagement and empathic attunement for continued and enhanced success in her acting roles. After much research, she could become the character she played. She had an amazing empathic ability to resonate with a character and then to develop that character from the point of reference of the persona of that character, and had a clear distinction of where that persona ended and where she began. By more effectively grounding and centering herself, cultivating mindfulness, she developed a greater resilience to the influence and emotion of others. She recognized how to automatically put the needs, how she had automatically put the needs of others before her own, and her career soared even higher. And I mention the detail here because to some degree, I believe each of you will have some variation for some of your clients with this very process. So there's an entire list in the outline of the difference between experts and amateurs. I want to just highlight a very few here because of time, and I want to save a time for any questions or comments. And here's one of my favorite quotes. Bum Phillips, who was the Houston Oilers coach back when all everything running back Earl Campbell was a rookie. He came out of University of Texas, and he was from Tyler, Texas, and was pretty green. And Bum took me aside. He said, "When you get to the end zone, act like you've been there before." And that was right in the heyday of all kinds of goofy stuff happening after people made touchdowns. So here are some distinctions. I just want to highlight a few. Experts continue concentrated, deliberate practice on focused areas to develop with informed feedback. Amateurs get to a level of good enough and stay there. Experts seek practice and goals that exceed current levels of performance. Amateurs seek to sustain a comfort level without challenging it. The expert loves and pursues the game, whatever the game is, with total dedication and passion. The amateur perceives it and pursues it as a sideline, part-time, like a weekend warrior. The expert knows that fairness is a childhood wish, that in adulthood there's not even an ultimate arbiter of fair. There is always adversity, unlevel fields, bad hops, rotten calls, injustice, unfairness. The amateur seeks fairness and is set back at what does not seem fair. The expert does whatever it takes, even what never could have been imagined. The amateur seeks and wants predictability, consistency, assuredness of results. The expert dedicates to mastery. The amateur dedicates to proving themselves, needing to consistently demonstrate superiority or competence. The expert shows up every day, no matter what, and is committed for the long haul. The expert understands delayed gratification. The expert is the ant, not the grasshopper, the tortoise, not the hare. The amateur shows up as long as something else doesn't get in the way. The amateur looks for shortcuts, quick results, immediate gratification. Experts know they can do best that which they do uniquely well. The amateur tries to do many things to be a lot of things to a lot of people. Just a couple more. The expert knows that the self and every storyline in life are created moment by moment, that the ultimate abandonment is of oneself. The amateur believes that much is predetermined, some fate, some circumstance, some luck, that consistent attention must be given to the appreciated, to be appreciated and accepted by others. The expert believes that we write, live, and create in order to know. The amateur believes that we must know in order to write, live, and create. The expert knows that courage is to proceed despite fear. The amateur believes that courage is the absence of fear. So, in our discussion now, the application of these principles of stress mastery and peak performance can apply to all areas of business, education, arts, health, human relationships, sports, parenting. As we become more self-reflective and better learners, ourselves as coaches, and know our story even better, we are more effectively not only writing our own story, whether life, career, wellness, relationship, money, we contribute to more effectively being a catalyst for the stories of our clients. Thanks so much for your time, your interest, as well as all the feedback and the kind words. I'll be eager to hear how you use and apply these ideas, if they're helpful to you, in your coaching practice to use as clients. We have a few minutes. I want to take us off of lecture mode and see if you have comments or questions. Anything you'd like to add or ask or discuss? I hope you'll feel comfortable to continue to give me feedback, and if there are any questions as you listen to this or as you look over the outline, fire off an email. I'll be eager to respond, and I'm eager to hear any application you have. And a final call for any questions or clarifications or additions, anyone. If I can be of help to any of you in any way, I hope you'll let me know. There's a Calendly sign up on the homepage of MentorPath. If you'd like to have a brief discussion at any point, pick a time. Thanks very, very much, and I'll be eager to hear any feedback that you have, and I hope this has been useful. Thanks very, very much.